Well, thank you, Bill. Sure is a pleasure to be here. Thankful to be here observing my 41st anniversary. And I'm also proud of this anniversary, because 41. In fact, I'm the first one ever got 40 or 39 or 38. And so I enjoy some of these firsts. I came into this fellowship in a very odd way. It's a series of miracles how I arrived here, because when I came here, there was no AA. Now, I came to a fellowship that did not yet exist. Now, only a rummy can do a thing like that. But when I came here, this fellowship that I came into was known as the Oxford Movement. Reg and his family know all about the Oxford Movement. They knew about it up in Canada. It was a worldwide organization, a religious organization. And AA was born in the Oxford Movement. And I was here before AA was born. I was one of the people that aided in the deliverance when the baby came. But anyway, it's nice to look back. And I think if a person can't help but look back over his life when he has an anniversary. I know even when you have your first one, I imagine it's very natural to just look back over the year and see what has happened to you in a year's time and what changes have been made. We have people here tonight. Just met Gary over here. He's at his second meeting in AA. And I just wonder what he'll be doing a year from now and what he'll be thinking about and what he'll be looking back upon. And I am hoping for the best for him, and I think he's going to have it also. But we look back, and I look back on my life, and I mentioned this a little while ago, that I can hardly associate myself with the character that I was 41 years ago when I arrived here. I came here, I was whipped, I was sick, I was beaten, I was homeless, I was broke, I weighed 130 pounds, and I really had no place to go. But my wife, Dorothy, at that time, I think Doc Smith, my sponsor, Dr. Bob, got a hold of her and talked her into giving me another chance back home, which she did, which was a lifesaver for me. And I stayed there about a year, pretty close to it. And she'd had a bad habit of throwing me out of the house with a disgusting regularity. And after a year's sobriety, she threw me out again. And this is something that sometimes happens to people. And it happened to me, and I had a hard time understanding it at the time, but I know and understand why now. Sometimes when we get straightened around, we've been a total loss. I know I was, and Dorothy had had to take care of everything and run the house and see if there was shoes on the kid and the rent paid and everything else that a man's supposed to be doing. And I was useless as far as I was concerned. I was between jobs for 4 or 5 years there. And so when I did come back and try to take my place, I was met with some opposition, which I don't fault her for that. I can understand it now. But it didn't work. And I got the bounce again. Well, anyway, that's another story. Looking back, though, I like to look back and recall some of the people and the persons who were involved in this back in those early times. We hear a lot, read different things about this fellowship, but I never hear anything, any words spoken about some of these people who were so important in the spreading of this word of ours here and opening up groups. And I think every once in a while, I think some of those people ought to be recognized. All we hear about is two people, I guess, mostly in this. And after all, they were just two. There were a lot of people responsible for the spreading of this fellowship here. Buck down here from Indianapolis, we're talking about it tonight, and he is asking me some things about Indianapolis, and he knew Father Fowl over there. I just mentioned to him that Irv Meyerson and I were the first people that called on Father Faust. And everyone knows what a part he had in his fellowship in those days. Like a lot of other people who came in the early part of AA, he was a very controversial character, and I think most of us were. That's the controversial in Akron when we left there that they never allowed me to come back to. So, I often think about this, and when we made our split from Akron and started the first group of Alcoholics Anonymous at Cleveland, Ohio, I was the guy that did this. He was responsible for it. I was the guy that wore the black hat. And those people, some of them got so distressed, they never spoke to me again. Some of them eventually relented, but not too many of them, really. But this is the way it went. And it had to be done. There were things that had to be done. I remember people, some of the experiences I had early in this life. When I landed in here, it's a long story how I got here, but it's a series of miracles. I was on the bum and landed in New York, and through a series of miracles, I became indirectly in touch with Bill Wilson and Doc Smith. And I didn't know Bill, but I did meet Doc, and Doc was my sponsor in Akron, Ohio. And he put me in Akron City Hospital, and this is where I got my first introduction to any alcoholics who were recovering. And none of these men had been recovering very long. It was just a matter of a few weeks and a few months for most of them, and the longest that any of them had was a little over a year, about a year and a half. So when I got here, everything was in the primary stages, I must say, very primary. There wasn't anything going at all for alcoholics as a whole. The alcoholics were meeting with the Oxford movement in Akron. Joe Wilson was meeting with the Oxford movement in New York at Calvary House. Dr. Shoemaker's church. And we were not, the Oxford movement was not an alcoholic rehabilitation situation at all. It was a religious group. Their theory was that anyone who is a real sinner and had some sins, want to overcome them, they could do it through the auspices and following the principles of the Oxford movement. They had a six-step program, which is the same program we have, only we elaborated on it and made 12 out of it. I suppose early in the game, we recognized that if alcoholics could screw up a two-car funeral, they could screw 12 steps up much easier than six. So we made these 12, these six steps of the Oxford group into 12, and when the book was written of Alcoholics Anonymous. Well, when I met these men, I was in the hospital. Doc put me in the city hospital in Akron, not for alcoholism, and he had me in there for acute gastritis, I think he had on my chart, and I suppose I had that too. But the hospitals weren't taking people in for alcoholism. Anytime you mention a rummy in a hospital, they'd throw you right out. And it was a long time breaking down that resistance and getting into hospitals. It was a long, tedious, uphill battle. And we finally got into some of them when we were ready to get into them. I think that the good Lord provides for us. Whenever we have a real need, He comes along and takes care of it. And when we had a need for hospitals, we got them. We had an awful lot of hospitals and dry-out places up there in Cleveland, where I came from, and one of the largest and probably the most successful ones that you'll find, and the oldest one that you'll find, is the Charity Hospital in Cleveland. They call it Rosary Hall, and I wouldn't bet that there aren't one or two or three people in here tonight that would have graduated from Rosary Hall. But it's been going for many years, and there's been thousands and thousands of people go through that from all over the country, not just from Cleveland. But it was a miracle the way we got into that place, and it really is. And I think about these things. We needed hospitals very badly, and what happened was we happened to get a hold of Father Nagel's father. I didn't know Father Nagel. He was running that charity hospital. But we got his father in this thing about 8 months before I ever met Father Nagel. Huh? Tell him that story? Well, you know, it's something. When the Cleveland Plain Dealer article came out in the fall of 1939, we got hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of inquiries from everywhere. And we didn't have too many men around there who could follow these up, but they all did the best they could. And all these inquiries came to me. And I would give each man a handful of these on Monday morning and tell him to report to me on Wednesday what he did with them, just like a sales manager does. And all of these fellas had a real missionary zeal. And they all went out and did it. They didn't squawk about it. They were anxious to have them. And boy, it really kept them busy. So I had a handful of these one day, and I way out on the other side of town, out in the Rocky River section of Cleveland, nice section of nice residential section, and I had this one name that was Mr. Nagel. It didn't mean anything to me, just another Irishman. I was getting a lot of them, and this was an Irish disease that cured in Methodist church patients, as you know. And this fellow, he was an older man. He was a fellow up in, I'd say he was up in his 50s. And went out to see him. And this man really was a prisoner in his own home. His family kept him under guard there because when he got outside, he was a disaster in the neighborhood. And they were a very fine family. It was a nice neighborhood. And so calling this old boy, and boy, he was all for quitting. He wanted to get out of that crap that he was in, you know. And well, he lived too far from me, so I turned his name over to a couple of the other boys out of his way and forgot about it, of course. Oh, I don't know, about 7 or 8 months later, I got a call from Charity Hospital. Father Nagel wants to see me. Well, when some hospital calls me, I'm right there, Johnny, on the spot. We want these services. So I went down to see Father Nagel. I never met him, didn't know what he wanted or anything about it. And the name I didn't recognize anything as far as his name was concerned. And I went down, I put the AA book under my arm and headed for charity. And so I went and introduced myself, and he said, sit down. He said, tell me all about this AA. What do you do to these people? I said, we fix them. We used to call it fixing. He said, yeah, I know you fix them, but he says, what's your technique? What do you do with them? So I explained to him what we did, and he sat there and listened and asked me a question now and then. So finally, I'm running out of conversation, which is something unusual for me. And I says, well, Father, I says, what is your interest in this thing? He says, well, about 7 or 8 months ago, a couple of your boys came out to see my dad. Says, now we can't even keep track of them. We used to have problems with keeping them holed up there, and now we can't keep track of them. He runs around chasing drunks all the time, brings them home and all that sort of thing, but he never drinks. He don't drink anymore. And it's just amazing. It's impossible. He says, that couldn't happen, but it's happened. So he wanted to know if there's anything he could do to help us. And boy, that's all I wanted to hear. I said, well, Sister Victorine over at St. John's has been giving us some beds. And he said, we didn't know this. So, by golly, what did he do? He called Sister Victorine over, got her transferred from that hospital over to charity, and he opened an alcoholic ward for men. And boy, Sister Victorine is the one that... She's the first nun that really ever did anything for us. I owe her an awful lot, and I pray for her too, always. And I still remain good friends with her, and to hear from her every once in a while. And that old gal's up in 80 now, and she knows she's supposed to be retired, but she won't retire. She's spent part of her time at the hospital. Yes, she's semi-retired, but she's afraid to let go of the thing because she can't trust anyone else to run it. But she has lived with this for many, many years. But after a while, they opened a women's ward there. And over these years, many years, there have been thousands and thousands and thousands of people who have gone through this ward that they call, Rosary Hall, they call it. So we have a lot of graduates of that. You know, I was very much amused one time. Every year, they have a get-together for all the graduates of Rosary Hall. I don't know if they still do. I don't know where they put them all now, but they were doing this for several years, and they had their, what they would do, they used to have a mass at St. John's Cathedral downtown, and all the people who graduated from Rosary Hall would attend this mass, and then after they'd have a breakfast. So this, after about 5 or 6 years of this, they invited me to come up one time to speak at this breakfast. And by the time I got up there were so many of them, the Protestants decided they'd have a church service too. So they had their service with a couple of rummy ministers over at the First Methodist Church out at 22nd and Euclid. So St. John's is down at 9th and Superior, and 22nd is out quite a ways from there. So here they both having the service at the same time. I attended the one out in the Methodist Church, and all of the Irish were downtown at the cathedral. And both services concluded at the same time, and they all headed for breakfast together. Now, they all were going to meet for breakfast. And where do you think they had breakfast? There's no place in Cleveland large enough to handle that crowd except one place. They were having breakfast at the Masonic Temple. You can't find anything like this except around AA, you know. But this is the way things broke down there, and a lot of this intolerance that used to exist, it sort of melted away, at least it did in our AA activity, in our AA life. Well, there's an interesting story about how that hospital started. We had other hospitals too, but you see, we needed that so badly at the time. And other ones that we got under similar circumstances, and our need was there, the good Lord always provides. All you have to do is ask him, and he comes too, and we get him. You know, people talk a lot about the beginnings of AA, and you read some of this stuff, and they overlook some of the main things. When I started out in this, I was in Akron. I attended meetings in the Oxford group in Akron for 15 months. And when I came out of the hospital, the night I came out of the hospital, Doc took me to this Oxford group meeting at T. Henry Williams and Clarissa Williams' home in Akron. They were the high moguls of the Oxford movement in that area. And that's where we had our meetings. They had a big home. T. Henry was a very wealthy man, and he had a young mansion back, you know. It had plenty of room to put a lot of people in it, and plenty of chairs. And I attended those meetings for 15 months. But when I left the hospital, Doc told me this. He had an admonition on me. He said I'd have to go back to Cleveland and spend the rest of my life fixing rummy as an avocation. He made that very plain to me. That would be the most important thing that I could do in my life, was to fix rummy. He said, you're a rummy, and no one else but a rummy can fix another rummy. That's been proven down through history. But now you have something to offer. You go out and get these people. Well, it isn't as easily said as done, because I'll tell you, I said it's easier said than done, I should say. When this happened, we had no book, we had no literature, we had no group, we had no nothing, we had no identity at all. We were meeting, we alcoholics were meeting with a lot of people who were not alcoholics, and most of them had the same idea and feeling about alcoholics that exists today. As most people down through history have been imbued with the idea that the alcoholic is a no-good slob, and that's it. He has no willpower, and he has no won't power. He does this just because he's ordinary, and he doesn't amount to anything. So most people have been conditioned down through history that the alcoholic is something less than human. And this is a thing we had to contend with, and I could see some friction coming between the alcoholic in the Oxford movement and the earth people, the civilians. But they were way in the minority, so we couldn't call it too loud. We were way in the minority, so we couldn't make too much noise about it. But it's a little flare-up of some here and there. So I went back to Cleveland, and remember, there's nothing there. There's no book. There's no program. There's no nothing. No literature. I had nothing. And I went out tackling rummies every place I could find. Get a hold of the Rumney on the street, and sit down with the social agencies, the judges, courts, any place at all where Rumneys were apt to be. And in those days, there were plenty of them wandering around. It was Depression time, and a lot of these men did not have any homes. And they were just on the loose, and they were staying through various missions and one thing or another. That someone would allow them to stay there a night or two, and they'd chop wood, and they'd so forth, and they'd spend a night there. There were plankton, many of them, men without homes. And I went out tackling these people, and then I got tackling them in the bar rooms and joints. Now, you can imagine what happened to me. Go into some jughead or a bunch of jugheads and make my appearance and tell them they could all quit that they could be like me. That's all I had to offer them. You can imagine what I got out of this. Abuse. And they all thought I was wacky. Which I probably was with the approach I had. I'll bet you I talked to hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of rummies over the next 7 months. It took me 7 months before I got my first rummy sold. I'll never forget that fellow if I lived to be 2,000 years old. Really. He was lying on the floor. There was a bunch of rummies. You know, in those days, people just left their homes. They couldn't pay for them, and they were foreclosed on, and someone just left them. And there are a lot of vacant houses around. Some of you people that are old enough to have some gray hair around here can remember those days in the Depression. So they just left, and these rummies, to keep out of the weather, they just take squatters' rights in some of these houses and move in. There'd be 15, 20, or 30 of them in a house. And they'd tear up the stairways and things like that and burn them up to firewood. One thing or another, it is a way of staying out of the weather. And they were all stayed drunk and all this sort of thing, drink anything they get a hold of, like bottle gangs did. And I found this guy over there, and I'll never forget this fellow. He had a ailment that I'd never seen before or since. He was lying on the floor, and he was so drunk, he was paralyzed drunk, he couldn't get up. He just lay there, but he knew everything that was going on. This first fellow was a Polish fellow. I'll never forget that. I have a good reason for it. And he was lying there, he was a great big fella. His name was Bill Hess. And he'd been an auditor for Sherwin-Williams Bank company in Cleveland, and he hadn't seen his family for several years. But he was paralyzed drunk, but he was conscious. This is an odd thing. This guy couldn't get up if I took him to heaven. He was lying there, so I got right down on the floor with him and talked to him about quitting good games. This is the first guy that showed any interest. I had a captive audience. So I asked him the next story question. I said, you could get a hold of 50 bucks so I could put him in the hospital for a week. I might as well ask him for a million. So I get some clothes, even out of 15 cents. No way of getting it. But he told me his mother had a farm out in Madison, Ohio, which is about 55 miles east of Cleveland. He says that if I go out to see her, he knows that she's got money stuck in the mattress someplace. You know, the banks have been all closed, and people either had it little lumps out in the backyard with it, or they buried their tin cans, or they had it in the mattress or the sugar bowl or someplace. He said, you go out to see my mother. She doesn't know where I've been for the last 4 or 5 years. I'll bet she'll get some money for you. That's all I needed. This guy's ready to go. I got a prospect. And I got a hold of a car, and I head for Madison, Ohio. Man, I got out there, and I shall never forget this day. It was the first day of hunting season, I discovered when I got out there. And I was afraid to drive back through this long lane back to the house because it was rather muddy and messy back there, and I was afraid of getting stuck. So I left the car on the road, and I started to walk back this long lane to the house. And heavens to dusty, I got about halfway back there, and my God, there's guns going off everywhere. It sounds like the battle of the mines. They're shooting, and I totally smoked these guys, and they're relatives, probably, of Bill's, his buddies. And they're probably all drunk and they're running around with guns and firing at everything that moves. Okay? Boy, I was an uncomfortable feeling. I don't forget it. So I debated whether to go on back to the house or beat it. But I went back to the house anyway. He took me not there. I got back there, but then I got my next big surprise. I pound on the door, and this little old lady comes out to the door. And she wants to know what I want. She looks at me. And Bill had overlooked telling me one thing. His mother was Polish, and she didn't speak a word of English. I'm 55 miles out of the country on a farm, gun. So I only know two words in Polish at that time. I know Yakshimash and Dubse, and you can only Yakshimash and Dubse so long as you run out of conversation. Well, there's a little kid there, one of the grandchildren, probably a little kid about 7 or 8 years old. And through that little kid as an interpreter, I put the story across to this old gal that I had her boy in tow, and I was going to fix him if I could just get $50 to put him in the hospital. And she was so happy to know that this kid was somebody's bounding that she'd have done anything. So she went in and cut a lump out of that mattress, and she brought this $50, the very big bills. Some of you folks remember those very big bills before they get them down? She gave me that cash money. And man, I let out of there. I didn't care anything about the guns. I beat it. And I got in that car and went back, and sure enough, Bill was laying on the floor yet. Same spot. He hadn't moved. He's still there. This is hours later, remember? I got some of those other jugheads to help me get in the car, and I called Doc and told him I'm bringing a customer. I'm bringing a baby down. We call them babies. I don't know. Somebody's calling them pigeons now. We call them babies. That's my first baby. Gee, I tell you, I was walking this high off the ground. I finally had accomplished something. Now I know why it took me 7 months to get my first baby. I learned this as time went on. There's something that you heard Grace read a little while ago in that fifth chapter that says something about carrying a message. I didn't have any message all those 7 months. It took me 7 months to get a message. Primarily I got one because Bill fell for it, or he got up for it. And after that, there came a succession of men real fast, and we soon had a dozen men going down to Akron. Well, that was an interesting story on the first guy I ever got. But things started to happen. That plain dealer series brought in so many people. And I remember after Dorothy threw me out, I was living in a cheap boarding house in Cleveland on Euclid Avenue, on 87th in Euclid. And there were about 30-some people living in that house, and about 6 or 8 of us rummies were in there, and the rest of them were different earth people of one kind or another, school teachers and a guy out of the Cleveland Orchestra. I don't know what those kind of people are doing in a joint like that, but they were living there. I paid $10 a week there, room and board. I got 2 meals a day and 1 on Sunday. And so I was making $20 a week with a drawing account selling automobiles. Here I don't have 5 cents to my name, and I'm driving 2 brand new automobiles. I got a new Mercury and a new Ford Demonstrator. They're mine. I'm hauling drunks around in these cars. I don't have any dough. I got $10 over my room and board. For that, I have to buy other meals. I have to get myself looking like something, get some clothes, and other incidentals that I had, and then I the rest of the money I squandered on women. I was the last of the great spenders. Well, I remember one day, I was AA'ing all over the place, you know, and I was in the boarding house there, and I see a fellow walk in. Boy, he was a handsome dude. He was a beautiful man. And he walked in there, and he had a heart-shaped and marked suit on. He had another one thrown over his shoulder, beautiful luggage. I looked at that turkey, and what's he doing in a place like this, you know? I didn't pay much attention. I was too busy. But he did. He stood out like a sore thumb in a place like that, you know. And I paid no attention, particularly. The next day I saw him. He still had the same suit and shirt on. He hadn't combed his hair that day. And the next day he's still growing a beard and starting to smell a little bit. And the next day he's really odoriferous. And he still has the same clothes on. He hasn't taken off. And by this time, he forgot to go to the bathroom a couple of times. And he's a mess. And every day by day, he got worse. But I'm busy, see? Well, as it happened, this old Irish woman, Mrs. Mack, where I rented this room from, this boarding house, if we were good and nice and paid attention to what we were doing, we don't start any fires in our room or anything, and don't get into too much trouble around the place, we could bring a guest to dinner for 50 cents. So I was going with a girl at the time, and I was trying to impress this babe. And I thought it'd be nice to bring her over to dinner one night. Big deal. It's 50 cents a big investment for me. And so I got to bring her over there and have her meet some of these inmates that I'm living with. And Mrs. Mack allowed us how I could do this, so okay. So I take this gal to dinner that night, and I'm a big host, you know, introducing her to everybody. And we sat down at this table, and there's a few empty seats around there. And I happened to look up just as we start our dinner, and I see this apparition standing in the doorway. Gee, well, this guy, his name was Willis Kilgore, and he was there about a week then, and he still hadn't changed his britches, and he was long beard like this, and he was really cruddy by now. And a week of this, you know, he's pretty good. And, what did he do? He walks right in and he plunks himself right down in front of us across the table from us. Now, I have this fancy date. I blow my stack. And this girl says, Clarence, don't do that. You got to fix him. And if I fix him, I'll kill him. I said, no, you got to fix him. So I take this bugger up and take him up to his room. There goes my date, my half a dollar investment, the whole thing shot. So I take him upstairs and find out who he is. Of course, he's tapped out. He's broke. He don't have any dough. And I found out he's from Atlanta. He's a salesman. His folks own a big lumber company and a toy company up in Atlanta. And he's out selling for the stores. He's on the road. He's a salesman. And, how he ever got out to the 8803 Euclid, he could never tell me. I didn't know. No one knew. God sent him there, that's all. And he had, the salesmen don't come out in joints like that. They stay out of a hotel downtown where they do the business. But he wound up in that place. Here's what happened to Willis. Willis had been up to Detroit. And the assistant manager of the Book Cadillac Hotel talked to him one night. He says, Willis, he says, you know, Willis had been in trouble in the Book Cadillac a few times before. And he says, well, he was sober then. This fellow, this manager, the assistant manager, says, Willis, he says, this fellow's down in Cleveland. I don't know who they are or where they are. They're sick drunk. He says, you ought to go down there and find these guys and meet them. You meet them. And here's the reason. So he got on a train and came down. He got off at the Union Station downtown. By God, he got on a streetcar of all things. And came right out there where I lived with about 6 or 7 other rummies. He could never explain this. He knew nothing about me. He knew nothing about any rummies. He didn't know anything else. But he landed in that very boarding house right there. And you tell me what this is. Okay? Well, I called his mother, Colette, of course, in Atlanta. And told her that I had him in tow, and she was very glad to find that out because she had been in these kind of problems before. And so I told her she wired me just to go up to 60. And she was glad to do that, so she wired me to go, and I put him in the sanitarium. And Willis never had another drink for a time day. He's the guy who went back to Atlanta. He's the guy who thought he could land with you. Another time, a fellow called me up. The editor of the Cleveland Press, Louis Seltzer. He called me and said, if you have a fellow that I'd like you to find, he's a good newspaper man. If you can find him and get him fixed, I'll pay all expenses involved for whatever it might cost. Is it this fellow? Is it this fellow's worth talking to? I said, well, where is he? He said, I don't know. I'm Skid Row somewhere in Cleveland. Well, it took a minute time. I sent a couple of the boys down in the Bolivar Road section. Many folks know about Cleveland, know that section. Sent them down there, and they went all through the abandoned warehouses and all these freight cars and things that these guys used to live in and stay in out of the weather. And they found him. They found him lying there on the floor, a brick floor of an abandoned warehouse, designing a peaceful connection with Mr. Newspapers in those days, and it's peculiar, I suppose. But if you learn how to build a net of newspapers, it's really an accomplishment. Well, that's where he was. And this guy was so thin and emaciated, I don't think he'd had 100 pounds, he wouldn't. He had one lung collapse, and he had a tooth stuck out of the other one. Really, this man was more dead than alive. So these fellows called and said they had him. They said they'd take him out to Post Baker's sanitarium and he's out there. They put him in Post Baker and called the self-controller and said, do anything that's necessary. He had to get special doctors for him to keep this man alive. He was in there for 6 or 8 weeks, I guess. He really paid the whole ticket. And when Larry Sewell was this fellow's name, and Larry got ready to leave there, and he got well enough. Billy says, it's no use for you staying around trees in this climate. It's no good for a man in your condition. You go any place you want in the country, I could say, if you're down the street. But somehow or other, Larry chose to go to Houston, Texas. So he got on the train and headed to Houston. And on the way down, he wrote a script by writing a series of articles similar to the ones that Albert Davis had written in Cleveland, somewhere. And he got down there and he went over to the Houston Press, which was a six-hour paper down at that time. And he sold the idea to the editor, and they sent him these things, and he got a job at the newspaper as a result of it. We got together with a group down there in Houston, and a few of them started AA in Texas. Let me figure this out, a man that's more dead than alive. The fellow came down to the Oxford meeting from Detroit sometime. The Oxford meeting was sent to this little guy, Archie Trowbridge. He was another little skinny runner, he was nothing but bone. And I never saw a man with so many phobias and fears as this man. This story is in the original book, the fearful one, that's his story. Well, Archie had been in Bruce Hunt's society. He had pictures of his wedding. They had a stovepipe hat and gloves and a cane and the whole bit, you know. But he didn't, his marriage didn't work out too well. He got drunk and stayed that way from the wedding day on, I guess. So as a result, his family and everybody threw him out. He was just owned even by his own family. And the people in the Oxford movement in Detroit sent him down to see Henry and Clarissa and Don Smith and asked them to see if they couldn't do something with him. That's when that Archie came down and committed it. And he was saying that to see Henry for a while, and he saw a doc for a while, and I could see Henry, that's the doc. And he was at no place. Just, he was saying phobia, that he wouldn't go, this fellow wouldn't cross the street. Yes, it's a phobia, he wouldn't step off the street, so he'd walk up as far as that corner, and he'd say to a doc, they had it as far as he was going. He couldn't get a step up, a street, don't they let him? He was just scared. He said that he was a street zone. Well, he has more phobia than anything I ever met in my life, or since. Well, he stayed for months down there. First he'd say that he and the next he was dark, and they'd bounce him back and forth, and they'd get sugar in one of them, and the other would get rid of him, and so forth. But he was staying sober because he didn't get anything to drink, I guess. And something happened. In those days, you had to chase people. Experiments of AA. You get some guy's name and leave it to town, they were living in the daylight about it. You don't believe it, read that story of that in the later issues of the book, the Al Golder story. I thought if you think I'm a gentleman, you see my name, you don't see that story. They tell how we can chase these people around. He tells it pretty well in that story. This is a good idea. Well, I've been chasing a guy there in Cleveland by the name of George McDermott. George was a great big brass Irishman. He was a sales manager for a Collinwood Shale Brick Company in Cleveland. He had a good job. And his wife was a great big fat Irish broad. And she was a nurse. And she was all mouth. I can remember that. And George, I kept calling on George, and George wasn't about to give up. He could still handle his booze. So one night, George went out to a hockey game. This was really something. And he got blown that big mouth of his off, and there were some other guys that closed it for him that night. And boy, what a closing up job they did on him. He was a unholy mess. So that finished George. George got ready to give in, so he called, his wife called, told me that George was ready to go to the hospital, which I'd been bothering with all winter long. So I arranged to take him down to the hospital that evening. I called Doc and told him we're coming, and now she wanted to go along. This old day, she knew everything. She was a nurse. She knew everything. And she wanted to let you know she knew everything, too. So I said, well, if we're going straight on to Akron, I said, he's going to have some booze on the way. You got any liquor now? He don't need any liquor. He's drunk enough. I said, he's going to squawk for a drink about every 5 miles on the way down there. So you might as well give it to him because this will be the last he's going to get anyway. So reluctantly, she went out and brought the jug out. And sure enough, every time old George was opening his trap, I'd give him a drink, keep him quiet. And every time he did that, she'd give me hell. And I got this all the way down there, see? And finally got old George down there and got him in the hospital. And boy, then it struck me. I got to go all the way back to Cleveland with this fat broad and listen to this stuff. And this was a very, very unwholesome prospect. Somehow or other, I should delay matters. I pulled around and pulled over to Doc Smith's house, Dr. Bob's house, and went in there. And there's Archie sitting there talking to Annie Smith. And why I did this, I don't know. Don't tell her. This wasn't any plan of mine at all. And Archie, that little skinny guy, he used to drive you bugs just to be around him. You know, he's so nervous. You're nervous looking at him. I says to Archie, I says, you know, Archie, they're driving me crazy up here. I got too much to do. Come on up and help me. Archie looked at me like I hit him with a hammer. No one in God's world ever asked Archie for anything. He was a complete washout. He was a nothing, see? And here I'm asking him to help me. And his mouth drops open. Now Annie wants to get rid of him. I know it is. Annie says, you heard Clarence. Go get your sweater and get going. So he turns around, he runs up and gets his sweater, and comes down and jumps in the car with me, and I put him in the back seat with the broad. And away we went. I let him keep her company going back there and kept her out of my hair anyway, what hair I had. And Archie came up there, and you know this, that nervous, scared fellow who wouldn't step out of a church zone. He got running all over Cleveland, A, and all over the place.